So tonight I'm going to teach you a technique. I'm going to lay out the framework of this technique over two lectures, and then on Wednesday evenings this summer, with the exception of 4th of July, which falls on a Wednesday, we're going to train one another and practice using the technique. And there are two reasons to do it this way. First, because it's tough. It's a very difficult technique. I've probably taught this to over 100 people, and having done so, I have yet to find a person who can do it after having heard it in a lecture. It is so fundamentally demanding, it requires us to rewire the way that our brains work, and so I've never met anyone who, having heard it, could successfully navigate it. So we need to practice, and we need to be corrected, and we need to learn from our mistakes, and we need to go through a process. It's a training process. So it's a lot more like learning to play the piano than it is like learning a mathematical equation. It has to be practiced to be learned. You have to learn to get your brain to do the part that it doesn't always want to do. The second reason for doing it this way is that it's important. It is a really important technique. We talk a lot about cataphatic and apophatic spirituality here at NRCC. Cataphatic is that process that happens through words, apophatic beyond words. Well, of all the cataphatic practices I know, this one is the most powerful and transformative. This one changes people more than any other that I know, so it's important. It changes people's lives. It really, really does. So, the other thing is, there are more people who need access to this technique than I have time or energy to get to, because it's a time-intensive process. And so, I'm going to spend my summer training you to do it, and then my hope is that you are going to say, I would like to help people experience this transformative power. So, at the end, I'll pass a clipboard, and you can say, yeah, having heard the first lecture, I think I might be willing to sign on for the training part. Otherwise, after two lectures, you can just exit. So, let's begin. People usually want to learn about conflict resolution because they're in pain. Often, they're afraid that they're about to lose something, lose a friend, lose a spouse, lose a partner, lose a child, and they're worn out from the fighting, worn out from the hurting, worn out from the pain. And so oftentimes this technique is found by people who are in a predicament. And if you are in a predicament, I will tell you this, it will work. It'll help you resolve your conflict. It'll get you through that conflict, and it'll do it very well. But it's really a technique for something else entirely. Conflict resolution is an off-label use. We're doing something else, and it just happens as a byproduct that we learn how to resolve conflict. The intended use of the technique is just what I said, cataphatic spirituality, the spirituality of understanding. It's spirituality that's rooted in insight, spirituality rooted in thought and understanding, and in this particular case, it's a spirituality that comes of self-understanding, self-awareness, and self-disclosure. It is just a technique for that, self-understanding, self-awareness, and self-disclosure. So, in all the time that I've been leading people through this, I've formulated in my mind a rule I call the 25-3 rule, and it says this. In an usual conflict arrangement with your conflict partner, you will find that your conflict partner does 25 wacky things, has 25 weak points, 25 problems. And 22 of those things don't bother you all that much. Perhaps they earn a snippy remark. Perhaps they earn a grunt or a snort, probably a rolled eye from time to time. But the three things, now they're an entirely different story, because when the three things are in play, well, Katie, bar the door, get out of my way, because something bad is going to happen. We're having a clash of the titans. That's right. Now, if a neutral outside observer were to come in and do an inventory of the 25 things, they wouldn't conclude that the three are intrinsically any worse than the 22. Now, sometimes that happens, but sometimes people do awful, awful things to each other, but it's the three that create these really sticky, troubling problems. So what's up with that? What causes some things to get under our skin and other things not? Well, this technique is going to suggest to you that the problem is usually not the objective badness of the thing your conflict partner is doing, but rather the interior world that that external thing touches, the interior wound that that thing touches, the interior belief that that external thing challenges, the internal truth that this thing exposes as untruth. If this is the case, well then self-awareness becomes a very big, big part of resolving conflict, of getting along with other people, a big part of resolving the things that flare up between us. What breaks relationships usually has much more to do with our own interior landscape than the external stimulus that evokes the response. It has a lot more to do with what's going on in here than how bad this person is out there. Now, of course, anybody who's ever had somebody get under their skin will vehemently object. Because what are you thinking, Doug? Of course, that is worse. You don't know this person I'm having conflict with. And sometimes that's true. Sometimes that is true. As I said, people do awful, awful things to each other. But most of the time, the thing that is at work fracturing our relationships is not objectively worse than the other things that are going on in the relationship. This outside observer, having seen the things, being able to dig out the thing, describe them, name them, only once in a while will say that it is truly a qualitatively different thing, the three, than the 22. Most of the conflict we experience is about the interior meaning that we assign to the event, the interior meaning that we assign to the incident. My perceptions have a whole lot more to do about the conflict that is raging than the knuckleheaded thing that my conflict partner is doing or is not doing. Now, as an aside, there's a caveat, and that is this, that evil exists. Harmful words exist. Harmful actions exist. And people can be and are perpetrators of both. And when this happens, the harmful thing must be challenged. It must be confronted. And folks who have accommodating tendencies in their personalities will hear what I've just said, that internal perceptions bear the lion's share of blame in conflict, and they will decide not to challenge the harmful thing, not to challenge the hurtful thing, because they will often think, it's probably me. They do this because confrontation is so difficult for their particular personality type. It's easier for them than to second guess themselves, even blame themselves, than it is to challenge what needs to be challenged. So be aware of that. Don't do that. But that being said, this technique has more to do with developing self-awareness, and it has less to do with hashing out fairness and equity in the midst of whatever conflict we find ourselves in. It's a technique for understanding why things bug us, asking ourselves what it means when we have this afflictive emotional response that we do, asking ourselves what our body is telling us, because our bodies don't lie. Asking ourselves the meaning that we have assigned to this action, to this incident. Asking ourselves what truths we believe at the root of who we are that causes this physical, this emotional response that we have. And then, after becoming aware of what's going on inside, coming to the place that we skillfully are able to disclose what we find, and then having our conflict partner grow into the ability to do the same. So, you can see, kind of right off before we begin, that this is a dangerous technique. This is dangerous stuff. Self-exposure is dangerous. Self-awareness is dangerous enough. It's much easier to focus our energy externally, to focus on the bad that is out there, to focus on the bad that is present in our conflict partner, because it's always there, and it's always easier to see, and it saves us having to look within. So self-awareness is hard enough, but self-exposure requires a special brand of courage, requires a special brand of insight into the nature of things, an experiential insight into the reality that we talk so much about. God is good. I am safe. Now, eventually, we become able to practice self-exposure much more freely. But in the beginning, we need a safe kind of relationship in which to do it. And that kind of relationship has to have present in it an affirmation of intent. As hopping angry as we get at one another, we need to affirm to the person with whom we are in conflict, I'm on your side. I'm not interested in harming you. I'm with you. I am for you. I may be mad as hell, but I'm on your side. Now, Denise is the person with whom I have practiced this technique the most, and part of our shared history together has been a copious use of the sentence, usually muttered with strained neck muscles and bared teeth, but nevertheless uttered, which is, I love you. You didn't know that because I am more angry than I can ever remember. I love you. Our relationship is not at risk, but I am as pissed as I have ever been. And in the early stages of this process of practicing this technique, this affirmation is very, very important. Honestly acknowledging that things are tough, but that I am on your side, I do not want to harm you. Sure, I want to lash out in this moment, but when I step back and in my sane moments, I realize that I want what is good for you. I do not want to harm you. This is an important realization that we have to have ourselves, and it's an important part of the process of communicating to one another. The implication of this necessary requirement is that in the early stages, we are limited in who we can practice this technique with. Until we are ready to practice self-exposure with abandon, that does eventually come. But until then, we need to practice this in relationships where the affirmation of intent is already in place. This is usually someone that is close to us, a sibling, a parent, an adult child, partners, friendships. As we'll see, the principles of the technique will work in other settings with work and neighbors, but at its core, it is a spiritual technique, a sacramental technique. And as such, especially in the beginning, we need to have it work in a context that is safe, a context that affirms good intent. So if you were not here on Memorial Day, then I did a lesson that day called the Sacrament of Covenant, the day before Memorial Day. If you didn't hear it, it's foundational to what I just said, and now you've got a homework assignment. You have to go online before next week, and you have to have a listen to it. So make yourself a note. Write it down. I need to go online and listen to that Sacrament of Covenant. So first thing is, it is a spiritual technique. It is used off-label to help us resolve conflicts with one another, but at its core, it's an exercise in self-awareness. It's an exercise in self-exposure. Second, it's a counterintuitive technique. It militates against everything we know about reality. I did a second foundational lesson recently. I think this was 2 weeks ago. It was titled Two-ness versus Oneness. In it, I talk about the fundamental changes that are happening in our post-Enlightenment minds and in our post-Enlightenment religion. Changes that are taking place at the level of our most basic view of reality. That lesson, too, if you didn't hear it, you need to go online and have a listen before next week. Because I said that everything that the physicists are telling us about reality is challenging our very idea of what we know about reality. Our five senses, we used to think, our sight and our hearing and our capacity to touch and taste and smell, all those five senses we used to think were windows into reality. But now what we're discovering is far from being windows into reality, they are prisons that lock us from reality. We do not experience reality as reality is. Our five senses are actually deceivers of us. I said that everything that we are learning about reality is intuitively wrong, everything we know about it. These prisons that keep us from reality tell us that we are separate entities from one another, that I am me and that you are you. Jesus and Paul, we saw in that lesson, intuited a long time ago that this is not so. They intuited what the physicists are now telling us, that the truth of our oneness over our two-ness is a false truth. When Jesus said, love your neighbor and love your enemy as you love yourself, this was an unrealistic impossibility as long as we keep the concept of two-ness firmly entrenched in our instinctive hearts and minds. Unless in some very real way I am my neighbor and I am my enemy, this teaching of Jesus makes no sense at all. But ever since kindergarten, when we learned in musical chairs that two bodies cannot occupy one chair at the same time, we have been having our senses tell us this fundamental truth, that I am separate from you, discrete in my being from you. Consequently, we've built up a reality on the basis of this intuitive sense of how the universe is. I am me, you are you. If I win and you lose, well, that's okay, because I am over here being me and winning. I'm at least in my separate me, I'm doing fine. And that would be okay if it was true and if it worked. But it isn't true and it doesn't work. And when we build our reality on that instinctive sense, it fails us again and again and again. It isn't true, and as a result, we build our lives falsely. Our lives don't work. Our relationships don't work. We live in this dangerous reality. We don't affirm our intent. We create dynamics in which one person lords over another person, one gender lords over another, one personality lords over another, and it simply doesn't work. But though it doesn't work, it's so deeply ingrained in our neural pathways, and it has been since infancy, that I am me and you are you. My first duty then becomes to protect me, to protect self. And my five senses have given me such a clear idea that this is the way things are, that I reside in this bag of skin over here and you reside over there. And again, all of that would be fine if it worked, but it doesn't. It doesn't work because it isn't true. It doesn't work between Greeks and Germans. It doesn't work between fundamentalist Muslims and secularist Westerners. It doesn't work between labor and management. It doesn't work between embattled husbands and wives. It doesn't work because it isn't true. But these neural pathways are deeply, deeply rooted. And we've used them and used them and used them so much that they have become like superhighways just running through our brains. And even though they don't take us where we want to go, they're the only roads that exist through this forest of neurons in our brains. And so consequently, we jump on that path and it takes us right where it always takes us. And it betrays us again and again and again. And this technique that I'm going to teach you asks you to abandon those superhighways and begin to bushwhack your way through the forest of neurons in your head and to make a brand new path, an uncomfortable, awkward path, brand new ways of relating based on a very different reality that you, conflict partner, and I are one, that our fortunes are entwined, that if you don't win, I don't win, that if you are not safe, I am not safe. That if you are cut off, then I am cut off. And this is a demanding brain change. It makes this technique very, very difficult. So let me tell you two things about the technique. Number one, it really, really works. I've seen it work scores of times with people who are in relationship-ruining conflict. I've seen it work in my own marriage that was on the cusp of ruination. I've seen it work in my friendships. I've seen it work with church folk locked in conflict. This really, really works, number one. Number two, it will not work for most people. For most people, it is simply idealism. For most people, it is pie in the sky. For most people, it's a dream. People come to this technique because they want to fix a relationship. But what they didn't bargain for was rewiring their brains. They didn't bargain for this much internal awareness. They didn't bargain for the level of work required to rewire one's brain. They didn't bargain for the character demands that you will see are required in message receiving. And so, because it is so difficult, for most people, it simply doesn't work. It tends to work for those who have a passionate desire for growth and folks who are desperate. If you're one of those two categories, it'll work for you. Either one is fine. Hopefully, you fall into the former category. But you should be warned, this technique that I will teach you this next week is going to be very, very difficult. It makes us feel inadequate. It makes us feel stupid. It brings up all kinds of ego resistance, especially at first. There is a novice stage that we must go through before we master it. It requires patience. It requires humility to continue following the technique until we have been able to learn it, internalize it. We need the humility not to speed ahead, not to take shortcuts. Most people don't apply this kind of sustained effort and patience that is required for things that are this difficult. Part of the reason it is so difficult is because human beings are ruled by habit. It's how our brains work, and rewiring habit is one of the most difficult things that we ever do. You've got a conflict habit already enshrined in your being. Conflict begins to brew. Blood pressure just automatically goes to where blood pressure goes. Tone of voice automatically goes to where tone of voice goes. Volume gets elevated just the way volume does. Neck muscles clench, shoulders rise. You've got the pattern, and you've got it well rehearsed, and all those systems are working fine, just taking you where you've always been. So, to review, this is a spiritual technique used off-label to resolve conflict. It's about self-awareness and self-disclosure, and thus requires a declaration of good intent. Second, this is a counterintuitive technique. It is very, very difficult. It is challenging the most fundamental instincts we have about reality, and it requires our fundamental instincts be changed, that we rewire our brains to line up with reality as reality is, a reality that we can't even access with our five senses. And so third, and finally, it is a technique that is not about fairness, and it's not about equity. Think about how most communication works. We communicate at the level of thoughts and ideas. I have an idea about what should happen here. I have an idea about what is appropriate behavior here. I have an idea about what a good friend or a good child or a good husband should do or should not do. I have an idea about how good people should spend their money. I have an idea about how good people should treat other people. And I have an idea about good people, how they should handle their emotions. And then you go and do something cross-grain to one of my good ideas, one of my thoughts about what should happen. Now, when this happens, it's easy. The solution is very simple. I just tell you what went wrong. Now, I call this the pass the salt level of communication. I have a thought. I have a need. I put it into words. I project it across the airwaves. It gets into your ears. Then it goes into your brain, and an action ensues. I say pass the salt. You pass the salt. Problem is figured out. Reasonable people do reasonable things, coming up with reasonable solutions. And the thing is, this works most of the time. It's amazing how often this works. I would suggest maybe 95% of the time this works. It's just that it happens without us paying attention to it because it works so well. And because it works so often, and because it works so well, it becomes part of our habit. It becomes the way that we think communication happens. It becomes the way we approach things. And as a culture, we agree upon some universally held values. Maybe we agree upon the value of fairness, or maybe we agree upon the value of sharing, or we agree upon the value of efficiency, or the value of mercy. And on the basis of these shared values, we work things out. And we do so with a fabulous rate of success. When one of us steps outside of this agreed upon shared value, we just mention it and things come back into line. If everybody shares the value at hand, perhaps it's fairness, perhaps it's efficiency, all we need to do to resolve a conflict is to call one another's attention to how the action doesn't line up, to how the word doesn't line up, and we suggest to one another how to repair this breach, adjustments are made accordingly, and everybody goes home happy. And again, this works a high percentage of the time, maybe 95% of the time. But it's that other 5% that gets really squirrely really quickly. Since pass the salt communication works so well, works so often, we pull it out even when it doesn't work anymore. We pull it out and we start working it and we start working it and we start working it. The idea that we need to learn a completely different language based on a completely different reality, this never occurs to us because pass the salt communication works so often. This form of communication negotiates a favorable outcome on the basis of a shared set of beliefs, values, and assumptions. And because we usually associate ourselves with other people who share our beliefs and our values and our assumptions, we get this high percentage of time when it works. But even then, when we're around people who are just like us, we don't always share values. We don't always share assumptions, and we don't always share beliefs. But you would be surprised, well, maybe you wouldn't, how often and how hard people fight to keep on relying upon this particular brand of fairness or this particular brand of justice or this shared value or this pass the salt approach. But our technique doesn't go there at all. And because we use pass the salt communication so much, we're going to find the technique very disorienting. It doesn't operate on the same assumptions at all. Next week, you're going to see that there's no place in this process for you to say a word about the other person violating a shared value. Next week, you're going to see that there's no place for you to say a word about what a self-absorbed prick she is. You're going to see that there's no place for you to champion the righteousness of the cause and to say, look how right I am. And so that ought to be alarming because we are really used to these pass the salt kinds of instincts. But I would encourage you not to be too alarmed because I bet you've tried that technique before. I bet you've tried communicating thoughts to thoughts. And when it didn't work, I bet you tried again with different words. And when it didn't work, I bet you tried with a little more voltage. And it still didn't work. And I'm going to suggest there's another way. The technique is designed for people who are operating with very different assumptions. It's designed for people to be able to resolve things when they function in different value sets and different realities. What we'll see next week is that when an afflictive emotion begins to arise and when a conflict begins to erupt, before you say a word, you've got some work to do, and it has nothing to do with your partner. It has to do with interior self-awareness. Before you say a word, you have to get beneath the realm of thought communication, and you have to start asking yourself questions about meaning. With paper in hand, you sit down and you begin to hash out the answers to a series of questions. What is happening to me? I'm having this negative response come up. What's going on? I'm having this negative emotion, this afflictive emotion. Why? What does that word that has got me so upset mean to me? What does that action, what does that circumstance, what does it mean? What meaning have I assigned to this thing that is interior to me? She says this, he said that, I'm reacting like this, okay? What does that tell me? What does that tell me that I is the meaning that I have assigned to that word, that I've assigned to that action, that I've assigned to this circumstance? Then we take our piece of paper and we go a little bit deeper and we ask ourselves, what is the physical response that I'm having? The experience that we call emotions, feelings, isn't really a mental experience. It's a physical experience. We have feelings because we feel them. There is a physiological response that we associate with anxiety. There's a different physiological response that is associated with fulfillment. We feel fulfilled. We feel anxious. And it happens somewhere in this body. We feel betrayed. And there is a feeling associated with betrayal. We feel uncherished. We feel diminished. We feel embarrassed. And there are physical things that happen inside of our bodies when we feel these things, just as there are physical things that happen in our bodies when we feel peaceful or satisfied. And as a culture, we've worked pretty hard to ignore and to suppress these physical realities. They do, however, have one attribute that makes them very, very helpful to us, and that is that they don't lie. They tell us exactly what is going on inside of us. When we are around the church, you hear the term, afflictive emotions are your friends. We say that because afflictive emotions are a diagnostic treasure. They tell you what's going on inside of you, and they don't lie. Our brains will often lie to us. Our brains will assign meanings that are very untrue to us. They deceive us all the time. They tell us that we are experiencing anger when in fact our bodies are telling us we are experiencing sorrow. And we've got to learn to distinguish between what our brains tell us and what our bodies tell us. So before we talk to anybody, we have some work to do. We've got to sit down with a piece of paper and do some self-awareness, question asking. What does it mean? What is my body telling me? And then we also have to dig in and find out what core identity issues is being brought up. Now again, we have yet to say a word to our conflict partner, but we do begin asking ourselves these core identity questions. What has been hit inside of me that is causing this afflictive emotion? If you've not heard the lesson yet, the welcoming prayer, that's another one. Now you've got three assignments to get done this week. You go to the audio site and you put in the term welcoming. It'll bring this lesson up. You'll learn a framing way to deal with the core reality issues inside of our souls. The core issues inside of us usually originate in fear or shame. They cluster themselves into responses around one of those two things. A fear response or a shame response manifests itself either as a power and control response, trying to control the frightening variables in our lives, or a security and safety response, trying to insulate ourselves from the frightening variables in our lives, or an affirmation and esteem response, trying to override the frightening variables in our lives by gaining honor and regard. This is an important thing to understand. Now again, you've not said a word to your conflict partner. All you're doing is asking, what's going on inside of me? You are informing yourself about what's going on. When we are up here, dealing simply in the realm of thoughts to thoughts, we're trying to negotiate a reality with our conflict partner blind. We have no idea what's going on. And so we talk and we talk and we talk and we talk and we make a better case and a better case and a better case and a better case, but we do so with our hands tied behind our backs and we do so blinded to the reality of what's going on. So no wonder we can't resolve the conflict. No wonder we come back to this same argument for 3 years, 5 years, 20 years. We come back to it because we never knew what was going on. And so the self-awareness being the first part of the process requires that we dig within ourselves and we ask, what is going on in me so that I can begin to negotiate from understanding? Most of the time when we do pass the salt negotiations, we're doing just that. We're negotiating something that works. And as long as we have shared beliefs, shared values, shared assumptions, that'll just work like a charm. But when we don't have them and we still keep trying to do that, it just embeds bitterness and anger and all of these evocative emotions that shut us down and shut us out. And so before we ever begin, we have to start digging in a quiet place with a sheet of paper. Well, as you will see by going through this process, you're going to find that this is a profoundly spiritual process. It is the spirituality of understanding. It's the spirituality of self-knowledge. It's the spirituality of self-awakening. The pain of conflict drives us to think thoughts that we would normally never think. The pain of conflict drives us to ask questions that we would normally never ask. The pain of conflict allows us to dig out answers that we would have been oblivious to had we not been embroiled in the pain. Questions that would otherwise not have surfaced, very important questions, the answers to which we would have never discerned. We would never have asked, what is happening inside of me? We would never have asked, what is my body telling me that I believe about reality? Now, next week, I'm going to begin to talk to you about the technique. And what you're going to see is a process by which we change and begin to communicate at the level of meaning to meaning, at the level of physical response to physical response, and at the level of identity to identity. And when we get to that place of understanding, we actually can have an informed negotiation. Every conflict resolution is a negotiation. You never get everything you want. If you do, you're a tyrant. If you do, you're not happy. Nobody ever gets everything they want. But everything that we negotiate, we can negotiate simply at the realm of thoughts to thoughts and just screw the whole thing up. Or we can become informed about ourselves. We can be self-disclosing and be informed about one another. And in that very intimate environment of self-knowledge and knowledge of this precious other, we can make an informed negotiation. We can begin to work for the well-being of the whole, not just of this separate entity that I call me. So, and that's the technique that I'll teach you next week on the practicalities of how to do that. That's it. That's the end of week one. We'll come back, do week two next week. What are you thinking about? What's stirring up in your heart?